This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The majority of humans on Earth are likely unaware that their 190 governments met in Cancun, Mexico in December 2010. Their goal was to agree on ways to save the planet's climate from a brutal catastrophe. Did anything happen? It depends on who you talk to. I'm Alex Smith reporting. In this Radio EcoShock special, you will hear five different voices on what really happened inside the barricaded conference rooms and outside in the streets. Our guests are Harvard professor Robert Stavins, Damon Moglen, head of the climate campaign for Friends of Earth USA, Franklin Lopez, anarchist filmmaker, reporting from the Mexican climate activist scene, British radio broadcaster Phil England with the European perspective, and South American expert Nicholas Kozloff on Brazil, Bolivia, and the road not taken. If you think international talks to save the Earth are boring, listen again. While we were waved away by mainstream press, the usual suspects from the World Bank to the American arm twisters busily tried to rewrite the script. Or were they really looking for a way forward? Will the rich make big money from climate suffering? From the victims of flood, heat, drought, and rising seas and dying agriculture? Without our attention and action, that could be the New Deal. There is a nexus of American analysts who find the Cancun COP16 UN conference was a success. The New York Times headlines, climate talks end with modest deal on emissions. Harvard professor Robert Stavins says Cancun, quote, must be judged a success. His article on the Cancun talks, What Happened and Why, an assessment of the Cancun agreements, has been widely republished in left-of-center media, including climateprogress.org and Alternet. It is the most positive, upbeat analysis I could find. We'll begin with Dr. Stavins, followed by the more critical voices.
Radio EcoShock.
Robert N. Stavins is the Albert Pratt Professor of Business and Government. He is the director of the Harvard Environmental Economics Program, among many other titles. Dr. Stavins, you've written one of the most positive outcome articles that I've found. Could you outline what was accomplished at the Cancun meetings?
Well, the first thing to start with is to recognize that when climate change is addressed, it's going to be addressed fundamentally by individuals and by companies, and that they are going to be acting in compliance with laws that are set up by national governments and state governments or provincial governments in some cases, and that the role of an international agreement is essentially to weave together what takes place at the national levels. The agreement that came out of the discussions in Cancun, which is referred to now as the Cancun Agreements, does that weaving together. It does it with an approach which generically is referred to sometimes as a schedules approach. It is bottom-up. It is not a set of legally binding requirements like the Kyoto Protocol was. But one should recognize that what's important is what's actually achieved, not whether it's legally binding or not. So, for example, in the case of the Kyoto Protocol, which is a legally binding agreement, we should recognize that as a result of the nature of that agreement, it was never submitted to the U.S. Senate for ratification, so the U.S. doesn't participate. As a result of the nature of the agreement, Canada ratified the agreement, but it's going to miss its target by 35%, so it doesn't, in essence, participate. And for that matter, approximately 140 countries in the world don't even have any targets under the Kyoto Protocol, so being legally binding has no effect on them. So my point is that when you look at an international arrangement on climate change, you have to ask what does it actually do, not whether it's legally binding or not. The Cancun agreements, in essence, codify under the United Nations what had been agreed to by the countries of the world last year in Copenhagen when they produced what was called the Copenhagen Accord. The difference is that the Copenhagen Accord was noted but not adopted by the assembled group because the chair at the time, Prime Minister Rasmussen of Denmark, caved in, essentially, to protests from five countries that are not particularly important, in fact are unimportant in terms of their emissions in the world, but are essentially leftist and left-leaning governments, mainly from South America, led by Bolivia, but also Venezuela and Cuba, that protested not so much the climate agreement itself, because they didn't really care about climate change. They were essentially protesting international economic globalization and the like, and they did it through this venue. So as a result of that, because of a total of five countries not agreeing, the fact that 139 countries did agree didn't mean anything, because the interpretation last year was that the rules under which the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change operates, namely consensus, meant unanimity, and of course 139 out of 144 is not unanimity. Fortunately, this year in Cancun, when things came to more or less the same place, it was again Bolivia leading the charge, and at the last minute, which was, as I recall, something like 2 o'clock in the morning, or last Saturday morning, actually, at 2 o'clock, the chair, very talented woman, the foreign minister of Mexico, Ms. Espinosa, she simply said, look, you know, 193 countries are in agreement, one country is not. That sounds to me like consensus. The Cancun agreements are adopted, and bang went the gavel, and that was the end of that, and 139 countries stood up and applauded. So that's how it was adopted, and that's frankly the difference between this year in Cancun and last year in Copenhagen. It doesn't solve the climate problem all by itself, by no means whatsoever. It certainly does not put the countries of the world on track to stabilize concentrations of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere at 450 parts per million CO2 equivalent, which is what is scientifically believed to be associated with a maximum 2 degrees centigrade warming, which is a target that many governments have now accepted. The Cancun agreements themselves actually codify that as a legitimate target. They talk about 2 degrees centigrade. That's the first time it's appeared in a UN-sanctioned document with any teeth to it. So it's important in that, but it doesn't achieve it on its own. So I view it as a stepping stone. It's a path in the right direction. If you want to get from Chicago to New York, you can ask yourself whether or not, you know, the first few steps you take get you there, or you can ask whether or not you're heading in the right direction. And this is heading in the right direction. It is without a doubt, it goes without saying, that it's the best that could be achieved at this point. But it's quite important, because it is the best that could be achieved. It not only has within it the targets and actions laid out by some, I believe, as I recall, it's something in the order of 80 to 100 countries who filed, who associated themselves with the Copenhagen Accord, now therefore with this document, the Cancun Agreement. But it's important that those countries that did represent about 80% of at least 2005 CO2 emissions. So it is a substantial part of the most meaningful countries in the world. Going beyond the actual mitigation targets and actions themselves, the second thing the agreement does is that it elaborates in important ways on mechanisms for monitoring and verification. This was very important to some countries. It was a very important concession by China, it so happens. And now the countries will report their greenhouse gas inventories to an independent panel of experts who will monitor and verify the reports on emissions cuts and actions. Third, what the agreement does is sets up what's called a Green Climate Fund for mitigation and adaptation. Importantly, in my view, the agreement names the World Bank as the interim trustee of the fund. That was over the objections of some developing countries. And it creates an oversight board, half of which will consist of donor nation representatives. The agreement also establishes a goal by developed countries to mobilize to $100 billion per year by 2020 to support mitigation and adaptation in developing countries. That funding target would include both public resources and private resources. In other words, in terms of private resources, carbon markets and private finance, bilateral flows and multilateral flows, as well as that Green Climate Fund itself. Fourth, the agreement advances some initiatives for tropical forest protection. That is what's often referred to as REDD+, reduced deforestation and forest degradation. Here, what was achieved in Cancun was not as great as what some of us had anticipated, because there had actually been considerable progress already with regards to REDD+. So much remains to be done. There's a whole appendix there of information on what are the next steps. And in fact, one of the nice things they've done in Cancun is they've laid out a plan of action of what will happen during this year. Fifth, the Cancun agreements establish a structure to assess the needs and develop policies for technology transfer to developing countries for clean energy and adaptation to climate change. Again, this is just the beginning of that process, but it sets out the basic structure, and countries will continue to work on that. In addition, the agreement establishes something that's potentially quite important, namely a role for the market-based mechanisms from the Kyoto Protocol to continue, and this includes the Clean Development Mechanism, which is obviously important to many developing countries. Interestingly, it indicates that carbon capture and storage projects will be eligible for carbon credits under the CDM for the first time. And then finally, there are some special provisions for the countries of Central and Eastern Europe and for Turkey, who are Annex I countries, who are at relatively low income to many of the others. So that's the 32-page Cancun agreements, more or less in a nutshell. As a member of one of the leading national delegations said to me in Cancun only a few hours after the vote had taken place and it was adopted, as he said, it's incremental progress, but it's progress nonetheless. And that is exactly the way I would describe it. It is probably the most important step that it's been taken in these international negotiations in approximately the last 10 years. I understand that it's not satisfactory to what many people would like to see. That's perfectly okay. But you've got to recognize that this is the most important step taken in international negotiations in 10 years. To me, that makes the Cancun agreements and indeed the Cancun talks a success. My first criteria of success that I'd specified before the meetings in Cancun was that the UNFCCC should embrace the parallel processes that exist, the major economies forum, the G20, and others. And here I would celebrate the leadership of Executive Secretary Cristiana Figueres of Costa Rica, who's now running the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. I think she's done that and done it very well. She no longer views these processes as competition to the UNFCCC, but as possible contributors. My second criterion for success was that the three tracks of the negotiations, namely the Kyoto Protocol, the long-term climate agreements, and the Copenhagen Accord, would be merged into two, if not one. And that's happened, because essentially what's happened is that the Copenhagen Accords have now become the long-term climate agreement track within the UNFCCC negotiations. That, it turns out, is procedurally a very, very important step forward. And then finally, my last criteria for success was that the Cancun meetings would maintain sensible expectations and thereby develop effective plans. And I think they've accomplished that. Overall, I think that the acceptance of the Cancun agreements by essentially, I think it's 193 countries, suggests that the international diplomatic community may now recognize that incremental steps in the right direction are better than acrimonious debates over what are fundamentally unachievable targets.
I know your time is limited, and I really appreciate your explanation of this. It's one of the best we've had. You've been listening to Harvard climate policy expert Dr. Robert N. Stavins. Thank you so much, sir, for your valuable time.
My pleasure.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Governments around the world sent ministers and experts to the December 2010 climate conference in Cancun, Mexico, but they wouldn't do much without pressure from citizens represented by thousands of non-governmental organizations, the NGOs, calling for real climate action. Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth are two of the best, and Damon Moglen has worked for both. He started out with Friends of Earth in Washington back in 1984. Damon has campaigned for the last 20 years on climate, energy, and nuclear issues with Physicians for Social Responsibility, the Union of Concerned Scientists, and most recently as Global Warming Director for Greenpeace USA. Now he's back with Friends of Earth, and he's the new Climate and Energy Director there. Damon Moglen, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you for having me, Alex. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
I appreciate you coming on at the last minute. We're doing a go-round, getting different voices and reactions to the COP16 Climate Conference. Let's start with Friends of the Earth. Did you get anything you were hoping for?
Well, I think that these negotiations are complicated, and unfortunately, powerful countries were very pitted in blocking real forward motion. But I think first of all, what we saw was that the UN process is still vital and robust, and that there is really a meaningful opportunity for these negotiations to move in a positive direction. I think that is good news. I think that there has been some good news on the international financing piece, where there is money being made available for developing countries who are in dire need of funding to help them to deal with adaptation and mitigation of climate impacts. Some of these countries really are on the cutting edge, and already people's lives are being affected, and in some cases even people are dying because of climate change impact. So that's the good news, but unfortunately it's very clear that the bad news far outweighs the good news. We did not get the agreement we urgently need.
To add pressure to those governments inside the security barriers, what sort of actions happened outside trying to keep that world eye on these talks?
Well, I think, as you said in your summary at the beginning, that thousands, literally, of non-governmental organizations around the world have been lobbying their governments and have been making demands. Thousands of corporations have been doing likewise, and there are huge pressures being brought to bear on governments by corporations, the fossil fuel industry in particular, oil, gas, and coal, who are really doing everything they can to stop these negotiations moving in a meaningful direction. But I think people power is having an impact. We see many governments who are taking the position that we've got to be acting and that the science is real and that this is a overwhelming global problem. And I think that we saw that in Cancun as well. There were organizations being represented by all kinds of people, both within the buildings of the negotiations and outside in the streets. And there were important and meaningful protests bringing together very broad coalitions of people. That's among the most powerful and important thing that we saw during the negotiations, that huge coalitions are forming and that those move across the lines from indigenous people to environmental activists, to labor activists, to people who are concerned about how we grow our food and what we do with it. So I think that there is some very powerful and benign forces that are working now together and in exciting and important ways.
I know our government in Canada went to the meeting to make sure there was no limit on fossil fuel emissions. We love our tar sands, and we've just got to pump them out. And I don't know whether Obama, with the new Republican elections, had any real support to do anything. What was your feeling? Did the United States play a positive role, or was it actually blocking some things?
No, I think, unfortunately, the United States has played a very, very negative role in these talks, just as they played an incredibly negative role in the Copenhagen talks. U.S. Ambassadors were really bullying and threatening other countries. I think that we've seen through the WikiLeaks that the U.S. has done a lot of really unpleasant and nasty backroom dealing. In a way, the most sad part of this is that President Obama, who ran so strongly on climate change issues and reflected such an important and valued position on climate change, has been completely missing in action. He has really failed to use the bully pulpit of the presidency to talk about the reality of climate science, the reality of climate change, the incredible impacts that we face, not only in our own country, but because of our greenhouse gas emissions over decades. What are the climate impacts that our country and our mistaken energy policy are creating around the world? So unfortunately, I think that what we see is an administration that has been shockingly similar to the Bush administration rather than dramatically different. So the U.S. did play a role at these talks of not only trying to block a legally binding agreement, but has pushed very hard for instead emissions reductions to be a matter of so-called pledge and review, which basically means countries are going to be able to say, oh, well, we'd like to bring about these kind of emissions reductions, and we pledge to abide by them. That is a far cry from the legally binding agreement that we need that is going to require science-based emissions reductions. So the U.S., unfortunately, has really played a spoiler's role in this, and I think that activists and organizations operating in the United States have got to come on harder and stronger. Finally, I do want to make a comment about the role that our new political reality in our Congress plays. Many people talk about the ways in which the split of Republican-Democrat House and Senate in our country are really a problem for future negotiations. I flatly reject that. Our Constitution is actually very, very clear. The President of the United States is responsible for negotiating international foreign policy. And the President, actually, President Obama, has used opposition in the Congress to justify his lack of forward motion on climate change issues. And that's unacceptable. The President is empowered to go out and negotiate an agreement. And that agreement is not dictated by the United States Congress. foreign policy was never supposed to be dictated by the Congress in that sense. And I think that all we need to do is look at arms control agreements, nuclear agreements, to see the ways in which the president has historically, on issues of the most demanding international importance, the president has always gone out ahead of the Congress and negotiated agreements. And that's what we need this president to do. This is a brilliant, dynamic president who understands these issues in a way that I don't think many other of our presidents has. What he's got to find out is courage and vision.
Well, that was really well said, I thought. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and we're talking with Damon Moglen from Friends of Earth. He's currently in San Francisco, but I guess you work out of Washington, D.C. Is the climate movement forming, or are we getting stalled? So many people are kind of complacent in fossil fuel wealth. And I want to ask you, too, is this United Nations process going to work, or is it creating false hope? What's your take?
Well, I think we have to have hope. It's been suggested that this whole climate change issue is kind of a giant and perhaps the most important IQ test that the human species has ever faced. And I think that's true. And for the moment, we're failing. But I think that we have the ability to take this on. We got ourselves into these problems. And I think that we can truly create both domestic policies and international policy that can protect our planet and protect ourselves and the wildlife and ecosystems around us. I think the bottom line here is that the UN process, like any other political process, has its problems, has its failures, has its flaws. But given that climate change is of international importance and implication, we need to support the international process. We need to support these UN negotiations. What we each of us as activists need to do is demand that our countries represent the science, represent the demands of the people, and negotiate in a transparent and committed way at these talks, and not as the lapdogs of corporate interests who are about money and not about our environment and about the future of our children and grandchildren. So the international process is something that I think we must remain committed to, but what we ourselves as activists have to do is demand that our governments participate in a meaningful way. The talks are only as good as the member states involved, and right now I think it's fair to say that both the Canadian government and the U.S. government have not participated in these talks in the effective and necessary way that we need.
In the past, Friends of Earth has been really good about exposing the banking relationships to coal production and things like that. How do you feel about the World Bank being proposed to look after this mythical $100 billion climate fund?
Well, these are serious problems. Friends of the Earth and many other organizations have flatly rejected the idea that if we're going to have a global climate fund, and there was some good forward motion in Cancun on this front, it must not be overseen by the World Bank. This is yet another example of putting the very people who got us into a lot of our problems in charge of getting us out of those problems, and that doesn't make any sense. The fox isn't supposed to be in charge of the hen house. The good news is that there were greater commitments made to building an international green climate fund. The good news is that it was recognized that the UN is going to need to play a greater role, and the UN and FCCC, the UN entity dealing with this. But as you've mentioned, for example, the World Bank is supposed to be on the trustees, and that causes some real cause for concern. I think that we need a new kind of solution to these problems, not the old failed ones. So we've got some serious work to do, and Friends of the Earth has, as you've said, historically worked very hard to kind of out these financial and business interests when they have sought to hijack these kind of processes, and we're certainly going to continue to do that. But I think that there's actually some real hope in where the Cancun talks managed to get us in terms of more money and a greater commitment to an international funding process.
Well, moving forward with the UN talks as we must, how do we move forward as we head towards Durban in 2011?
Well, I think there are two critical issues here. First of all, as you and your listeners know, we have a landmark agreement on climate, the so-called Kyoto Protocol, which is going to be up for renewal in 2012. And one of the most shocking things that happened during the Cancun talks was an effort by a number of countries, including remarkably Japan, to in effect assassinate the Kyoto Protocol, to argue that we don't need that protocol and that we should let it lapse. That is not at all the case. And what this is really about is under Kyoto, governments had to make legally binding commitments. They have real obligations to bring down their emissions. So first of all, what we need to be doing is we need to see the Kyoto Protocol renewed for a new period of time during which these obligations are at least maintained, if not increased. That's the environment in which we need to be negotiating in Durban towards a new, legally binding, science-based, equitable international climate agreement. So, you know, there are these two things. We need to hold the line on Kyoto. We need to make sure that we're negotiating in an atmosphere of legally binding obligations. And we need to negotiate a broader, more demanding agreement in line with the science for Durban. And so, you know, we've got our work cut out ahead of us, but I think we can manage both of those things.
Damon, as we wrap up, can you give us a website or two where people can follow up?
Well, absolutely. I mean, people are very welcome, and we'd love to see people coming to our website. That's www.foe.org, friendsoftheearth.org. And certainly there are many, many other organizations that are doing great work. You mentioned Greenpeace. I think that Greenpeace's analysis is also very important. So that would be www.greenpeace.org. So those are two of them. But there are an array of wonderful organizations doing work, and I encourage people to look at various sites, and there are certainly many, many places to be going for good information.
Okay. Speaking for Friends of Earth, our guest is Damon Moglen, Climate and Energy Director and a lifetime environmental activist. Thank you, Damon. I hope we can talk again as the struggle continues.
I hope so too, Alex. Thank you for giving me some time to talk with you today.
Right. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. You are listening to a Radio EcoShock special assessment of the Cancun Climate Talks held in Mexico in early December 2010. It's your planet, your kids' future. I'm Alex Smith with five interviews, five voices on what you need to know. This is Radio EcoShock, and when we need a critical eye on the street, Franklin Lopez is the man. He's a cameraman, he's a producer, he's a super video editor, an anarchist, an activist. He's based in Vancouver, but roaming where the action is. As the stimulator, his free-swinging videos get millions of views. His video podcast is It's the End of the World as We Know It, and I Feel Fine. And that says a lot about Franklin, I would say. In December 2010, Frank was at the United Nations Climate Conference in Cancun, Mexico. He was on the streets. Frank, I'll bet you were not there to get sound bites from the usual talking heads. Why did you go to Cancun?
Well, primarily I went to Cancun to screen a film that I just completed called NCIF. And just shortly, it's a film based on the ideas of Derek Jensen, and I felt that the film was really made for environmental activists. And I wanted to have it ready for the COP15, but that was just physically impossible. But the second reason I went there was to report on the grassroots activism that was going to happen around the COP16. So I joined a caravan of buses from Chiapas, from the city of San Cristobal, about 250 of us divided into five buses, 23 hours through the treacherous roads of Mexico. And we finally made it through five military checkpoints and to one of the two activist camps that were set up in Cancun.
Did you get a hard time from people as you were going there? And were these camps hospitable to alternative media?
Both camps were very grassroots. Actually, the folks who organized the bus caravan were organized in a space called Espacio Mexicano, or Mexican Space. And that was a collaboration between a bunch of different groups, including Otros Mundos, Friends of the Earth, and Oxfam. I ended up not staying at that camp. I went to the Villa Campesina Mexico camp because that's where the anti-capitalist bloc, they were calling themselves anti-cop, were set up.
Radio EcoShock will be right back with more of Franklin Lopez, the anarchist filmmaker, outside the security fence at Cancun in the Climate Talks.